together in a giant spiraling circle. It was as though they were running laps, spiraling and spiraling together, a squirming black whirlpool of ants. It shows you the power of pheromones. Ants follow one another by their pheromone trails. When you see a line of marching ants, it means that each ant is following the chemical trail of the one in front of it, picking up the scent with its sensitive antennae. But every once in a while, something happens that breaks the pheromone trail. A log falls on the middle of the line, for example. And suddenly, some ant in the middle of the chain now finds himself at the front of a new one. He panics. I'm anthropomorphizing here, but bear with me. He runs around like crazy, searching for another pheromone trail to follow. Eventually, he finds one and starts following this other ant. But unbeknownst to him, he's just found the pheromone trail of the ant in the back of his own line. And then the column turns into a loop that winds and winds in on itself as the ants, blindly following one another, simply run around and around in circles until they die. And I thought, pheromones. Chapter 64. Inta, Russia, 25 kilometers south of the Arctic Circle. Scrambling, huffing, nearly 10 meters up in the tree, Cheslav Prokopovich stops climbing and tentatively leans out, distributing his weight carefully along the limbs of the Siberian pine, which are getting thinner at this height. Through the mesh of crisscrossing branches, he can see for several kilometers down the rocky river valley, its horizontal visual panorama interrupted only by the tall and starkly looming transcontinental radio tower that is the reason for the village's existence this far north. But sightseeing is the least of his concerns this afternoon. Prokopovich carefully unstraps his rifle from his back and flicks a downward glance at the forest floor, looking for the other members of his hunting party. From this height, Sasha, Jirg, and Kirill look identical. The three Russians are wearing army boots and cheap camouflage hunting coveralls. All of them are stocky, bald, and chunky-featured, as if they're built out of rocks. Lifelong friends and residents of Inta, the four men had worked together in the nickel mine that opened in the heady times after the fall of the Berlin Wall. Their annual late-summer hunt is supposed to be a time of respite before the snow and ice come, before the Arctic temperatures drive them inside and underground for 6 months beside the fire. 6 long, boring, maddeningly sedentary months of bottomless cups of vodka and endless hands of Durak. All year, Prokopovich anticipates this excursion, especially the sunny moment before he bags his elk. That full body tremble of excitement, the childlike splashing of his heart inside his chest. His heart is splashing now, Prokopovich thinks, as he breathes on his rifle scope and dries it with his sleeve. The weapon Prokopovich presses to his cheek is a handcrafted Mosin Nagant hunting rifle. Through the scope's reticle, he scans the boreal forest of evergreens, firs, and pines that green the landscape. He is looking for any slight sign of movement. Specifically, he is looking for the wolves that have been chasing them since morning. There are several dozen, maybe more, the biggest and most aggressive wolves he has ever seen. Why so many wolves have decided to pack together and come after them, Prokopovich does not know. He only knows that if Kirill had not woken up early to take a piss and seen them in the distance, loping up the mountainside like lava flowing in reverse, they might already be dead. Prokopovich rests the sight on the rattletrap rail bridge that spans the ravine they crossed earlier. The abandoned rail line was built by Gulag prisoners in the 1950s, when Inta's network of government labor camps was still running. Their plan had been to head up the mountain across the dilapidated old bridge. They thought the wolves would be unable or too afraid to cross it. Up in the tree, he spies the bridge through the rifle scope, waits, and watches. Prokopovich is thinking about his wife when the wolves break cover from the tree line en masse and head for the ravine. Tichu Zagalima, Prokopovich mutters to himself as the animals head straight for the bridge. He watches as they begin to fastidiously work their way across, gingerly picking over the decrepit wooden ties and iron beams, one by one, paw by nibble paw.
Blaya! Prokopovich says to the sky. Zebula!
Whore! Fuck it all! Chapter 65.
Spitting out a sticky pine needle, Prokopovich rivets his eyes on the approaching wolves. They are moving fast, but he tries to count them. Soon, the task of counting them becomes overwhelming. He can't. There are too many. What he sees is impossible. He has heard of packs of 10, maybe 15. Surely there must be 50 wolves spilling out of the trees, funneling over the bridge after them. Prokopovich straps the rifle on his back and hurries down the tree.
"What now, hunter men?"
Kirill says, warming his nerves with a plug of vodka from his canteen. Kirill's face is cauliflowered and inflamed with rosacea. His eyes are like raisins. Prokopovich pauses for a moment, frowning. It is not Sasha, who still plays hockey, or his cousin Jurg, the weightlifter, whom he is worried about. It is the largest of the men, his best friend, Kirill, who causes him concern. The big, boisterous fool is squatting against the trunk of a tree, wheezing like a concertina from the exertion of the morning's uphill march. Kirill is fat as a swine and smokes like a broken truck, and is as slow-moving as sap in January. Dead weight, Prokopovich thinks grimly, looking at his friends.
Blaya, we run, you drunken pig! We run for our lives!
The wolves are a swarm of gray dots down in the distant valley, slaloming between trees up the mountain. They make no noise, no barking, no howling. Only silent running.
Hurry! Run if you want to live!
The men have one last chance. There is another bridge over the ravine, a little less than a kilometer farther north. It is in even worse shape than the first one, a mere skeleton of a bridge, with no ties at all. They will have to scale the outside of its rusted latticework frame. An almost suicidal enterprise, especially for poor fat Kirill. But there is no other choice. At least there is no way the four-footed wolves will be able to cross that. The problem is getting there in time. They are within sight of the bridge when Kirill drops. He looks terrible. He huffs at the air like a fish out of water, hacks into a fist. His face is swollen, the color of borscht.
Borscht, nit,
he says between gasps.
No more, kind, not one more step.
Damn you! Prokopovich gives him a savage kick. For all the good it does, he may as well have kicked a tire.
Nodak! Get up, you son of a whore!
Blaya, Blaya! Jurg adds. My wife isn't going to be a widow because you're a fat fuck.
Podait! Go, both of you!
Prokopovich says as his knees crunch in the pine needles beside Kirill.
Kirill just needs to catch his breath. We will catch up with you at the bridge.
Sasha and Jurg do not need to be told twice. In a breath, they are gone. Prokopovich holds Kirill's heaving shoulder and gazes forlornly through the trees at the distant Ural Mountains, looming to the east.
Go, Cheslov,
Kirill pants.
Don't do this.
His beady eyes look defeated and miserable.
Jurg is right. I am fat and useless. I am too weak. Always have been.
Kirill is a clumsy, bumbling fool, laughed at by one and all. What redeems him, what has always made him Cheslov's best friend, is that Kirill himself is always the one who laughs the hardest. Prokopovich checks the ammo in his rifle as he sees the wolves beginning to race through the trees.
I'm sorry,
Kirill said, as the panting of the wolves becomes audible now. Kirill is weeping. His voice is cracked and whimpery.
I always loved these hunts. You are my great friend, Cheslov. I never became a millionaire, but I am rich to have had you for a friend. Weakness!
Prokopovich hawks a dismissive gallop of spit in the pine needles.
Shut up, you poof, and take up your gun. We're going to leave.
As the wolves approach, Prokopovich looks down the valley. It is crisply sunny at this elevation, but the plain beyond the bridge, where the village is located, is overcast, bathed in a dark purple-red glow, as if lit by a black light.
So this is where I die, Prokopovich thinks.
Then, the first wolf, a male with eyes as yellow as the moon, steps into the clearing. It is a monster of a thing, 50 kilos at least. When he was a child on a hunt with his father, Cheslov saw a wolf smaller than the one now before him take down a bull elk.
Too bad I am not a bull elk, Cheslov thinks. Stand up, you fool, he says to Kirill.
Kirill heaves himself to his feet. Together, they stand back to back, with their guns facing out. Prokopovich knows what to do with wolves. Stand your ground. You stay put, they respect you, you live. You run, you die. The wolves begin to gather around them. More and more come. The groups of wolves begin to mingle, merge, intermesh. Snarling, growling, teeth snapping, staccato bursts of threat barks. The wolves form a circle around them. They advance. They retreat. The air is filled with a cacophony of barking. Prokopovich can feel Kirill quaking against his back.
Stand still, mudak, he grumbles at Kirill behind him. We stand our ground, we live. We run, we die. They smell your fear.
Ito bastards, ito bastards.
Kirill is half whining, half mumbling.
This is so fucked up. This is so fucked up.
Kirill squeezes the trigger of his gun and a shot goes off, from the hip, aimed almost at random into the crowd of wolves. Czeslaw feels the gun crack against his elbow. A jet of blood leaps into the air, like a squirt of bright dark berry juice, and there's a whimpering howl.
Kirill! Prokopovich shouts. No!
He hears Kirill pull the trigger again, another howl and a spurt of blood. A wave of fresh agitation moves all throughout the circle, a swell of freshly crazed barking.
Whatever, Czeslaw thinks. Fuck it.
And he, too, fires a shot into the crowd. They kill about 7 of them. More keep coming. Then Kirill decides to run. He leaves their post in the middle of the circle and tries to bolt. A moment after he does, just a fraction of a moment later, a sliver of time so thin an eye blink does not describe it, the circle of wolves rushes in to close. Their bodies become a whirlpool of fur, roaring throats, thrashing legs, ripping jaws, all piling on top of each other. Prokopovich squeezes another fistful of bullets into the horde, but it is useless. The wolves swarm over the 2 men until they disappear beneath them. It goes on for several minutes before the clamor dies down. The pack loosens and the wolves separate, rove the field, sniff the ground, begin to tumble and growl, not in earnest violence, but in play. Czeslaw and Kirill are gone. There are no bodies left to speak of. There is blood smeared across the floor of grass and pine needles. Many of the wolves have bloody snouts and mouths, and some of them lick blood from their damp, matted fur. Some of them squabble here and there over bones. But the men themselves have disappeared.
Chapter 66. I'm sure I looked like a zombie who had freshly clawed his way out of the crypt when I flung open the door of our apartment. I heard the clink and scuttle of Chloe putting away groceries in the kitchen. I left the keys in the lock and sprinted down the front hallway. As I stood in the kitchen doorway, Chloe looked at me as though I had gone completely crazy. I looked it. I was slathered with black filth and breathing hard after running back from Bryant Park. But I wasn't crazy. For the first time in years, I knew I was right. Hi, I said.
So, she said, how was the meeting with the mayor?
Her voice was sarcastic. Incredibly productive. Chloe stood up from where she knelt beside the open refrigerator, closed it.
The mayor's office just called. What the hell happened to you?
I took the jar of salsa she was absentmindedly holding and set it firmly on the counter. I held her by the shoulders as I struggled to catch my breath.
I figured it out.
My voice was choked with excitement. I tried to calm it.
The reason for the attacks, it's not a virus. It's pheromones.
Chloe looked at me askance.
You're not making sense, Oz.
I started to collapse onto a chair next to the kitchen table.
Don't touch the furniture,
said Chloe. I remained standing.
On my way to the meeting, I saw a stray dog, I said. I followed it into a tunnel beneath Bryant Park. Inside were more dogs. Thousands of them.
Chloe nodded, mental gears turning.
You saw another dog pack? She said. Like the one on the video?
Yeah, I said, nodding. I started to wipe sweat from my eyes with filthy fingers, thought better of it, got to work on blinking it out instead.
But here's the thing. They were all grouped together, rubbing against each other, behaving in a way I've never seen before. They were mating, regurgitating food. They had these chambers where females were giving birth.
Disgusting, said Chloe.
Then she began backing away from me, her hands flying to her face.
Mon Dieu! What is that smell?
She said, finally catching the full brunt of the dog sludge I'd crawled through.
Exactly!
I shimmied out of my shirt, my pants followed a moment later. I was leaving black streaks on the kitchen tiles. I rummaged through the kitchen drawers in my socks and underwear, found a plastic bag, and threw the clothes inside, tying it tightly. We need to test my clothes. It's their smell. I think the dogs are emitting it, but they almost weren't acting like dogs, Chloe. I know this sounds insane. They were acting like insects, like ants or bees or something. It's not a virus like rabies that's making the animals go haywire. We need to test for some kind of new pheromone in the environment.
That's crazy,
Chloe said, still covering her face. Is it? I said. This whole thing has been staring at us in the face from the beginning. How do animals communicate? Subconsciously, I mean. How do dogs, bears, hyenas recognize one another, their environment, their territory?
Secreting and sniffing pheromones,
Chloe said. Life, at its most basic level, is chemistry, I said. Right?
Hmm?
Groups of molecular compounds reacting to other groups of molecular compounds. When an animal sniffs a rival or a predator, it receives information that changes its behavior. That's what's occurring here, in some way. Except the animal's signals are getting crossed somehow. The signals they're getting are making them act against their instincts. There's something new, something wrong, either with the pheromones themselves or the way the animals are processing them.
It might make sense,
Chloe said, getting into it now.
The mutations we found in the animals were in the amygdala, which usually governs the sense of smell.
I paced back and forth across the kitchen in my underwear, still holding the sagging trash bag full of my reeking clothes. I think it may even have something to do with that bizarre stuff that went on with Attila, I said. A chimp's sense of smell isn't that great, but I rescued him from a perfume lab where they were doing chemical experiments on him. I think the pheromone or whatever it is in the environment somehow made him go crazy.
Like a steroid or something,
Chloe said.
Are the animals exhibiting a kind of chemically triggered rage?
Could be.
But why all of a sudden?
Chloe said.
What's changing the way they perceive pheromones?
I don't know. But I do know that we need to find some pheromone experts and put them in a room yesterday. More like 5 years ago. I'll call the lab. You call that government guy, Leahy. I think we finally caught a break on this thing. Chapter 67. The rest of my morning consisted of a Silkwood shower and a Jerry Lewis telethon's worth of phone calls. By mid-afternoon, Chloe, Eli, and I were sitting around the kitchen table with our bags packed and ready to go. I guessed our ride was out front when my phone went bzz, bzz on the table and unknown number popped up on the screen. I went to the window and looked down. When the NSA chief, Mike Leahy, said he was sending a car to take us to a secure location, I thought he had meant, well, a car. On the sidewalk in front of our building was a camo-colored, up-armored combat Humvee with a soldier manning a machine gun in the steel-plated turret. For traveling with a low profile, I guess. A young kid with orange hair and freckles, straight out of Archie Comics, met us in the lobby downstairs. He saluted. "Lieutenant Durkin, U.S. Army 3rd Infantry," he said in that military cadence, a forward tumble of barks rising in pitch. "Jesus, is it getting this bad out there, Lieutenant?" I said, gesturing at the war machine we were apparently about to enter. Durkin hoisted our bags as though he were a valet and led us toward the Humvee. "Manhattan below 96th Street is in the process of being evacuated," he said. "We're starting with the hospitals and hospice facilities." "What? Why?" "Rats!" As we rolled north through Manhattan, we saw barricades, checkpoints. The city was swarming with men and women in camo. The only vehicles that passed us going in the opposite direction were government evacuation buses and more army Hummers. Times Square was empty. I glanced at the darkened marquee as we passed the Ed Sullivan Theater, where they tape Late Show with David Letterman. No stupid pet tricks tonight. When we turned west on 57th Street, we heard the whoosh of fire and looked out the window to see two soldiers in silver suits kneeling in front of an open manhole, aiming flamethrowers beneath the street. We stopped on 5th Avenue and 81st Street. A chain-link fence, braced with sandbags, had been strung across the avenue in front of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. The Upper East Side was occupied now? When had all this happened? And why hadn't I heard about it? The world had flipped from normal to bizarre in what, hours? Things had seemed fine to me that morning.
These two blocks are HQ for the time being,
Durkin said as a guard waved us through the makeshift fence.
This kind of reminds me of the Green Zone in Iraq.
Or Ground Zero after 9/11, I said. We rolled past sandbag trailers and stacked crates of bottled water and came to a stop in front of a stately granite pre-war building directly across from the Met. The building's interior was all gilded ornaments and Corinthian columns, glass, brass, marble, potted ferns. Durkin led us into the grand lobby where an NYPD sergeant checked our IDs and, for no discernible reason, wanded us with a metal detector, including Eli, just to make sure our three-year-old boy wasn't packing heat.
Who's in charge? I asked Durkin. Colonel Walters, but he's in the field.
The field?
Well, the city. I think some of the other scientists are here. Let me show you to your quarters first.
They were nice quarters. The apartment we were let into was a multi-million dollar duplex with massive fireplaces and 12-foot coffered ceilings. The living room was cluttered with marble sculptures and African masks. There was a Chagall on the dining room wall. Fancy digs. How'd the army sublet Xanadu? I said to Durkin. He shrugged.
Ours is not to reason why, he said. You guys settle in. The meeting's on the first floor at 1600 hours. Enjoy your vacation at the end of the world.
Chapter 68. We left Eli in a makeshift daycare center that had been set up for the scientists' children on the building's fifth floor and went downstairs to help prepare for the meeting. I was surprised at how quickly Chloe and I adapted to all this doomsday scenario stuff. One day you drop your kid off at pre-K, the next you take him to a government evacuation center's daycare facility. What else could we do? In a large alcove off the sweeping marble lobby, we worked with camo-clad army techs to convert a dining room into a conference room, complete with an interactive whiteboard. The table was a sleek, oblong, blood-colored mahogany, its surface so glossy it reflected light as sharply as a mirror. The room was huge, the ceilings 15 feet high, with marble cornice moldings in the corners and dark oil paintings of robber barons set in the walls. A chandelier dangled like a bunch of crystal grapes above the table. Over the next hour, Chloe and I greeted the other scientists whom the government had shuttled in via Hummer and helicopter. In addition to my colleague Dr. Quinn, they had recruited most of the rest of the lab staff from Columbia, as well as more than a dozen top-drawer entomologists, environmentalists, and other scientists.
Ah, look who it is, I said to Chloe behind my hand. Dr. Harvey Blowhard.
Chloe rolled her eyes. Dr. Harvey Saltonstall, the Henry Wentworth Wallace Chair in Biology at Harvard, shook my hand and gave me a cold, curt hello. Being proved right before your enemies is a pretty good feeling, and I couldn't help but smirk a little. I did not like this man. Last time I'd seen him, he was on the other side of a split screen on MSNBC with Rachel Maddow moderating. That was more than a year ago. As usual, he'd made me look like a wingnut bozo with his whole aristocratic persona, this handsome devil in tweed, occasionally swiping back his elegant shock of silver hair. Harvey Saltonstall's prominent public opposition to HAC had delayed progress for years. Now, why wasn't I surprised that the officious, elitist asswipe was front row and center in the government team assembled to solve the problem? Soon I was standing at the head of a conference table ringed with the country's best and brightest. I hoped all the expertise gathered in this room would be enough, and that we weren't too late. I started out by quickly going over what I had seen that morning under Bryant Park. At first, I thought HAC had a viral origin, I said, looking around the table from face to face. Everyone nodded back at me. But after seeing the animals up close today, acting in such a bizarre way, I think it's time to take a new approach. I think this has to do with pheromones. The dogs I saw today were displaying textbook pheromonal aggregation behavior. It's my belief that some new kind of morphed pheromone has entered the environment, and it's probably our doing, because we seem to be one of the only mammals whose behavior isn't affected by it.
We came here for this. Harvey Saltonstall took a long, fastidious sip from the coffee cup in front of him, while everyone waited for his next words. The environment, please.
This theory is infantile. A pheromone is a chemical that's very specific to communication within species. I've never heard of the same pheromone affecting multiple species. Are you suggesting there's some invisible, crazy gas affecting all mammals except humans? Why should it not affect us? Irritating as he was, I knew Saltonstall had an excellent point. He'd immediately stuck his finger in the biggest hole in my theory. I bit my lip and thought. Chapter 69. Harvey Saltonstall made a prim cage of his fingertips and began to accordion them in and out, readying himself to redouble his attack. And then, Chloe jumped in to save me.
"What about pollution?" she blurted.
"Yes, well, what about it?" Saltonstall said.
"Pollution in the environment sometimes causes mutational changes in animals. Take nylonase, for example. In a wastewater pond beside a nylon factory in Japan, they found a species of bacteria that only eats nylon. The presence of the pollution genetically altered the bacteria that were already there."
"This stuff is all well and good when we're talking about pollution," said Saltonstall. "But I thought we were talking about pheromones. What does pollution have to do with pheromones?"
I rapped my knuckles on the table. "Hydrocarbons," I said. "That's where pheromones and pollution connect. Pheromones are made up of hydrocarbons. So is petroleum." Around the table, everyone sat up a little straighter. My mind was racing. I couldn't help it. I sprang to my feet and started pacing behind my chair.
"Hydrocarbons are everywhere," I continued. "Over the last 200 years, from car traffic and industrial activity, there's been a massive increase in volatile hydrocarbons in the atmosphere. Methane, ethylene."
"Not to mention the prevalence of petroleum," Chloe said. "Petroleum is in everything. Plastic, house paint, balloons, pillows, shampoo. It leaches into the groundwater."
"Didn't studies in the 90s explore the health hazards of plastics due to their chemical similarity to estrogens?" Dr. Terry Atkinson added. He was a chemical engineer from Cooper Union. I felt like diving across the table and giving him a high five. I didn't.
"Yes," I said, "if hydrocarbons can mimic estrogen, it's entirely conceivable that they can mimic pheromones."
"Or take the plastic compound used in water bottles," said Dr. Quinn, jabbing a pen in the air. "They found that it caused the estrogen levels of fish to skyrocket for some reason. In a lake outside a manufacturing plant in Germany, researchers found that there were no male fish present at all."
"We are flying down the wrong path here, folks," Saltonstall insisted. He cleared his throat and swiped back his silver shock of hair with his hand. "How do chemical hydrocarbons change without some sort of catalyst? Plastic has been around for over 50 years. If it affected the way animals process pheromones, wouldn't we have noticed it long before now?"
I let out a breath and tried to come up with an answer. Saltonstall again had raised a good counterargument.
"Excuse me, Mr. Oz," said Betty Orlean, an environmental scientist from the University of Chicago. "Quick question. When did you start noticing this increase in animal aggression?"
"As far as my data show, around 1996, I said. "But it didn't start getting bad until the aughts."
"1996 is right around when cell phones started becoming more popular," Betty said a bit cryptically. "And cell phone use has exponentially increased since then."
The thought was half formed in her head.
"So?" Saltonstall said.
"Well, Dr. Saltonstall," she said, "we know that cell phones use radio frequency energy, which forms fields of electromagnetic radiation. Some animal functions at the cellular level can be affected by such fields. The fear for years has been that one field could disrupt the other. That's why there have been so many studies about the link between cell phone use and brain cancer. For years, our world has been swimming in an unprecedented sea of radiation."
"Yes," I said, really going now.
"Perhaps cell phone radiation is somehow cooking the ambient environmental hydrocarbons in a way we've never seen before, morphing them into a chemical that animals are picking up as a pheromone. And it's changing their cerebral physiology, as we've seen at Columbia. We know that the affected animals have bigger amygdalae."
"Oz, I believe I remember something," Dr. Quinn jumped in. "It was a study about bees in the Netherlands."
She spoke slowly and distractedly as she poked at the laptop open in front of her.
"Yes, here it is. I'll put it on the smart board.
A moment later, a graph-peppered scientific paper appeared on the screen.
This was a study done in the Netherlands in the 90s, she said. It shows the effects of radiation on bees whose nest was relocated beside a cell phone tower. As you can see in Table 1, when the bees were in the forest, they had no trouble foraging and returning to the nest.
She got up, walked forward, and pointed at the curving lines of a graph on the screen.
But here, in the second graph, it shows that when the nest was placed next to the cell phone tower, the bees took longer and longer to get back, until the hive eventually died off. I, for one, am intrigued by Mr. Oz's theory, Dr. Orlean said. I think we may have our culprits. Pollution from hydrocarbons and electromagnetic radiation from cell phones have coupled together, resulting in critical biosphere meltdown.
There were nods all around. Harvey Saltonstall was visibly irritated. You could see the steam escaping from his ears. But that still doesn't explain why these alleged hydrocarbon-morphed pheromones don't affect human beings. Can you explain that, Mr. Oz? He gave the mister a very slight emphasis to remind everyone that I didn't have a PhD. I bit my lip again, but only to create my own dramatic pause. I did have an answer.
Human beings lack the vomeronasal organ, I said to Saltonstall. The tissue at the base of the nasal cavity that causes response to airborne pheromones. Almost all mammals have it, but not humans. In fact, there are theories that the human VNO may have diminished as our relationship with dogs evolved. As it got bigger in dogs, it went away in humans. Many of the genes essential for the VNO are completely non-functional in humans.
I looked around the room and realized I had won it. Saltonstall sat there looking as though I'd yanked his pants down, so I assumed he knew what I was talking about. Dr. Orlean smiled at me.
Bravo, Mr. Oz, she said. I don't think anyone can deny that this is a breakthrough. I think we finally hit the jackpot. For the first time, I feel like we have a good chance of understanding what's causing HAC.
Yes, but unfortunately that only leads us to the next question, I said. How do we stop it? Chapter 70. A battered police van emits a feeble, oscillating shriek as it weaves through the clogged, dust-choked streets of East Delhi, India. Behind the van's wheel, newly appointed sub-inspector Pardeep Sikkar nearly clips a fruit vendor as he wipes sweat off his face with the sleeve of his khaki shirt. The fruit vendor erupts into a torrent of curses, and Pardeep answers him with a dismissive wave.
Clean the dirt out of your ears, bumpkin, he half-heartedly grumbles out the window. That sound from my van? That's not a demon, but a siren. It means out of the way, police coming through.
Pardeep blames the television and internet for the last decade's influx of rural migrants into the city. All those channels luring illiterate fools into the bright lights and Bollywood lifestyle they will never achieve. When they can't find work, they turn to petty crime, pickpocketing, purse snatching. That's where he comes in. At the next traffic-glutted intersection, he laughs to himself as he watches a guy trying to maneuver his cherry red Lamborghini around a donkey cart. An Italian luxury car revving around a jackass is 21st century India in a nutshell. Digital age meets Stone Age. If only I had a camera, he thinks. The men back at the station would love it. Pardeep's beat is Yamuna Pushta, the largest slum in Delhi, which puts it in the running for the largest slum in the world. In every direction lie blocks of jhuggis, makeshift huts made out of wood and cardboard, tied together with string. The shanty town has no electricity or sewers. Today, people are flying kites and playing volleyball. Naked children sit grinning as they play in the dirt. Pardeep brings the van to a stop in front of a three-story concrete housing block beside a particularly fetid section of the Yamuna River. The Yamuna is a tributary of the Ganges. Bathing in its sacred water, according to the holy men, is supposed to free one from the torments of death. Pardeep rolls up the window and through the dusty glass, takes a look out across the smooth brown surface of the polluted cesspool. He sighs and shuts off the engine. It would free one, all right. But not from death, from life. He looks up at the grim three-story complex. River Meadow Apartments. They make it sound pleasant, don't they? The calls that have been coming in from the building are confusing. People screaming about a break-in, a crazed killer stalking the hallways. Pardeep shrugs his narrow shoulders. Looks quiet enough from the outside. Probably a prank. Still, he lifts his newly issued weapon off the floor of the passenger side footwell just in case. It's one of the Indian-made INSAS submachine guns that have been handed out in the years since the Mumbai terrorist attacks. He casually shoulders the strap and heads for the building. In the back of his mind, Pardeep idly hopes it isn't a prank, but a real-life terrorist. He would love nothing more than to blow some foreign-born radical scum to smithereens, maybe get promoted out of the city's armpit in the bargain. He's trying to decide which plum district he would like to be assigned to when an old man runs screaming from the building.
Raksasam! Rana! Atanka!
He warbles as he runs past the van. Monsters. Horror. Run. Monsters. Pardeep smiles to himself, amused. This is a prank. Probably kids playing tricks on some superstitious old fools.
Hello, police,
he says, entering the lobby. It's deserted.
Police!
The smell is awful. It smells like shit, garbage, death. Which is to say, nothing unusual for this neighborhood. There's no response. He starts up the stairs. At the top of the first floor landing, he sees something moving in the dimness down at the end of the hallway. It's low to the ground, perhaps about waist level. In the windowless corridor, it looks to Pardeep like a woman with a blanket over her, crawling on all fours. He is confused. He reaches for his flashlight, takes a few steps closer. Then there is something moving at him very fast down the dark hallway. He clicks on his flashlight and sees bright eyes flash jewel green in the darkness. Then he is falling backward. Pardeep doesn't have time to scream as the leopard opens him from belly to chin. Two more leopards arrive, skulking slyly in the hallway. The leopard is one of the most dangerous animals in the world. The beautiful turquoise-eyed creature is sometimes called a leaping chainsaw, due to the fact that it uses both its rear claws and its razor-sharp front claws, as well as its teeth when it strikes. Before a dark mist falls over his eyes, one last word floats up from Pardeep's mind. Raksasam. Monsters. Chapter 71. I had a dream that night. I dreamed of a circle of ants. They chased each other in a spiral, a squirming black whirlpool, turning around and around, each one blindly chasing the pheromone trail of the ant just in front of him. A closed circle. A snake biting its tail. A symbol of futility. Locked in their loop, the ants ran around and around in circles, desperate, stupid, doomed. I didn't know what time it was when I woke up in the dark to the sound of what sounded like the world ending. There was an alarm going, ee-ee-ee. It sounded as though I were on a submarine that had just been torpedoed. I clawed at the sheets and scrambled to sit up. Smoke detector? I thought. Some kind of military alarm? Then I saw a light pulsing on the bedside table and realized the sound was coming from my iPhone. I vaguely remembered my son Eli playing with it the day before. 3-year-old kid knew more about the stupid thing than I did. I snatched it off the table and shut it off. Kid had set it to some crazy DEFCON 3 ringtone, which was actually funny in a morbid way under the present quasi-apocalyptic circumstances. My heart started beating again, and I almost laughed. Then I answered it.
Mr. Oz, sorry to bother you at this hour, Lieutenant Durkin said. I have a message for you from Mr. Leahy of the NSA. A high-level meeting is scheduled at the White House this morning. The President will be there as well as the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Mr. Leahy has requested that you be there in person to present the new theory you and the other scientists have developed.
I wiped sleep gunk out of my eyes. What? Another meeting?
Okay, I guess,
I said, clicking on the bedside lamp. My brain was still woozy.
Your wife and son are free to come with you, but since travel is becoming dangerous, I might suggest it would be safer to leave them here in the secure zone. We can have you back up here by dinner.
That's fine, Lieutenant. When am I leaving? I said.
Your flight out of Teterboro will be ready to go in about an hour. Can you be ready in, say, 20 minutes?
20 minutes, I thought, inwardly groaning. The meeting last night had gone on until well past midnight,
It felt like I'd gotten about 20 minutes of sleep. Of course, I'll meet you in the lobby, I said. After I hung up, I immediately called Leahy. Why the face-to-face, Leahy? Why don't we just teleconference? It's complicated, Mr. Oz, Leahy said. I know it's a pain in the ass, but I really need you here. You're a persuasive speaker. I blinked. What was Leahy talking about? Persuasive, I said. What does the president need to be persuaded about? I'll tell you when you get here, Leahy said. I smelled fish. For some reason, the needle on my bullshit detector was jittering. The last thing I wanted to do with the world falling apart was leave my family, but it looked like I didn't have much choice. Fine. See you later, I said. One of Chloe's eyes peeled open as I was coming out of the shower. The president and the joint chiefs of staff at the White House are having a meeting, I said. They want my input, face to face in D.C.
Back to D.C. again?
Chloe said, opening her other eye and sitting up.
But you can't. It's too dangerous. Can't they, I don't know, use Skype or something?
That would make sense. This is the federal government we're talking about. Sounds like they need some convincing on the pheromone angle. Until they're on board, we won't be able to make progress on tackling this insanity. Besides, I'll have a military escort the whole way. They said I'll be back before dinner. I was heading for the front door of our lavish government-assigned apartment when Eli poked his head out of the room we'd put him in. Hey, kiddo, I said, kneeling down next to him. Did you change my ringtone?
Maybe,
he said. I messed his hair and gave him a hug. Listen, Monsieur Maybe. I'm going to Washington. I need you to stay here and take care of Mommy for me until I get back tonight.
No, Daddy,
Eli said, his face crumpling. I stood up. He hugged my leg.
I can't take care of Mommy. Don't go. You have to stay here. I don't want you to go.
By the time Chloe helped pry him off me, I felt like crying too. Shutting that door was the hardest thing I'd done any time lately. I met Lieutenant Durkin in the lobby and we proceeded outside. Alongside the sandbagged gate strung up across Fifth Avenue, soldiers and cops were drinking coffee in Anthora cups beside a convoy of up-armored Hummers and police cars. The row of engines idled, quietly panting exhaust into the brisk white beams of the headlights. Are any of the other scientists coming with us? I asked as Lieutenant Durkin and I climbed into one of the Hummers. My orders were just you, but if you want to bring some of the others, I can check. I waved off the idea. I was slightly surprised, but I actually liked it better that I was the only one they'd asked for. We rolled through half a dozen checkpoints on the way out to Teterboro. As we were coming up the ramp for the George Washington Bridge, I noticed a black column of smoke rising in the distance above the South Bronx. Lieutenant Durkin looked at the smoke and then back at me. There have been problems with the evacs, he said, looking away. Some looting and such. We're trying to keep a lid on it. Chapter 72. When we arrived at Teterboro, Lieutenant Durkin drove us through a gate in a chain-link fence right onto the tarmac. Off to the right, beyond the doors of a nearby hangar, a sleek, cream-colored business jet began slowly taxiing toward us, its wing lights blinking. I couldn't help but notice that it was the top-of-the-line Gulfstream G650, a luxury aircraft that can hop the Atlantic and reach speeds near Mach 1. If they thought they could impress me by rolling out a G650 to take me down to D.C., they'd succeeded. Then I had another thought. All this? For me? What was up with the sudden VIP treatment? This definitely didn't seem like your standard government travel itinerary. Was I being buttered up for some reason? What the hell was this meeting about? Lieutenant Durkin stayed behind on the tarmac. Another military guy waved me toward the air stair, and I boarded the plane with nothing but the suit on my back. The Gulfstream had flat-screen displays over mirror-polished teak desks and leather executive chairs you could sink into as though they were pudding. The interior was furnished in the manner of somebody's corner office, I thought, as I chose one of its 8 empty seats and sat in it. A corner office that flew at 51,000 feet and more than 700 miles an hour. Not that I had much time to enjoy it. The flight attendant handed me a cup of coffee before we took off, and I was still sipping it when the Gulfstream's wheels skidded with two soft shrieks against the tarmac at Reagan National, an amazing 25 minutes later. The jet's engines whirred down as we taxied. I looked out the window. There was something strange about the airport. There were jumbo jets parked along the terminals, but they weren't moving. No other planes were on the tarmac. Nothing was taking off or landing. It looked as if the airport were closed. It was 8 a.m. on a Tuesday. When we approached the terminal, I saw that there was some activity here after all. Lined in 2 vast rows were dozens of military aircraft, Harriers, Warthogs. Marines were scampering around, loading and unloading tandem-rotor Chinook helicopters. I slowly realized the airport had been commandeered by the military. Chapter 73. I got a call from a number I didn't recognize as I felt the plane jerk to a halt. I answered as the flight attendant unclipped a bracket and the door yawned open with a happy hum.
Mr. Oz, it's Dr. Valerie. I have the test results.
Dr. Mark Valerie was a biochemist at NYU whom I had asked to do a chemical analysis on the muck on my clothes.
What did you find? I said.
Your pheromone theory seems spot on, Valerie said. Your clothes were saturated with a chemically unique hydrocarbon similar to dodecyl acetate, a common ant pheromone. I say similar because it's like it, but isn't quite the same. This stuff has properties we've never seen before.
What do you mean? I said.
The carbon chains are strange, very strange. The substance has an extremely high molecular weight. Unlike dodecyl acetate, this stuff seems to dissolve quite slowly, which might help explain its unusually strong effect on larger animals. But that ain't all, it turns out. The animals aren't the only ones who seem to be secreting a pheromone.
So are we. What are you talking about?
Long story short, a human being's scent is very complex, Dr. Valerie said. We secrete materials from several different types of glands. There's regular sweat, secreted by the eccrine glands, and then there's sweat from the apocrine glands, in the hairier parts of our bodies. Then there's sebum.
That's the substance that contains our smell, I said.
Right. Sebum is the stuff that bloodhounds hone in on when tracking an individual person.
Our olfactory fingerprint.
The fragrance industry has been doing sebum experiments for years. I used to help run some of them. The thing about sebum is, like pheromones, it's chock full of hydrocarbons. That's why, after hearing about your breakthrough, I decided to test some skin swabs from humans. I used myself and some of the other lab workers as subjects.
What did you find? I said.
It turns out that our sebum is chemically different from some samples I found in a similar study that was done back in 1994. I don't know if it's the air, our diet, seepage from plastics, or what, but initial tests seem to indicate that our sebum seems to have a new compound in it, with pantanol and methyl butanoate. Not only that, but this new compound's chemical structure seems to resemble several insect attack pheromones.
I stared at the floor of the plane, trying to piece together what I was being told.
So you're saying the animals are attacking because of our smell? I said.
It's not just them. It's us.
Think about it, Mr. Oz, said Valerie. The olfactory system of most mammals is incredibly strong. A dog's sense of smell is about 100,000 times more powerful than a human's. The power of olfaction is primal. And it seems the critters don't like what they're smelling.
Chapter 74. With these new and even more troubling implications playing polka in my head, I exited the plane and was guided by a couple of soldiers toward a shiny black and chrome government motorcade thrumming by the hangar. If our innate human odor was helping to cause this chaos, how are we supposed to fix that? How could we humans have changed what we smell like on a molecular level? How could it have happened so quickly? And why? I approached the vehicles, a marked DC police car, a black Suburban, and another military Humvee. A stocky Marine in full camo shook my hand. He was Hispanic, and his spiky high and tight made him look like he was wearing a hedgehog as a yarmulke.
Mr. Oz, he said with a slightly cockeyed grin.
You're that animal scientist guy, right? I saw you on Oprah, man. Welcome to the war zone, formerly known as Washington, D.C. I'm Sergeant Alvarez, but call me Mark.
Do you have any bags or some beakers or something I can grab for you?
No beakers this time, I said distractedly as he opened the door of the SUV for me.
So, what are you down here for? He said, getting behind the wheel. Let me guess. Tour the cherry trees? A Nats game?
We were rolling now. I was trying to think. I wished he'd shut up. Actually, I'm starting up a brand new drug testing program for Marine Corps personnel, I said. In fact, when we get to the White House, I'm going to need a urine sample. A long, silent minute dragged past. That was a joke, I said. Sorry, I have a lot on my mind.
No problemo, Doc. I talk too much. Ask anyone, Alvarez said. You sit there and solve the disaster. I'll just button my lip and drive. This is me, shutting up. Zip!
A few minutes later, we were near the Pentagon, approaching the I-395 ramp before the bridge, when I heard what at first I thought were honking geese. Then a mass of animals burst from the roadside trees. Body after furry body spilled out from between the tree trunks. Dogs. Dutch shepherds, caramel-colored mastiffs, foxhounds, bloodhounds, greyhounds, mutts of every conceivable coat and color and size. The dogs snarled and barked, a din of barking. Fur flew, spit sprayed up from the horde in frothy flecks. Most of the animals were filthy, crazed-looking. They looked sick, starved, haunted. Many of them had hides that were mottled with that same white fungus stuff I'd seen under Bryant Park. It was horrific. I felt sorry for them. The mass of dogs didn't so much as hesitate as it approached our motorcade. The charging herd spilled right out into the road like lemmings off a cliff, right under the lead patrol car's front wheels. Sergeant Alvarez came close to rear-ending the police car as it hit its brakes.
The fuck are you ass clowns doing?
Sergeant Alvarez yelled into his hands-free headset at the driver of the cop car.
Now's not the time to be breaking for animals, cockwaffle! Go! Go!
There was a series of yelps and whines, and then sickening thumps under the wheels as we ran over the dogs. Our car bucked and rocked over them like a rubber dinghy in a storm at sea. We thought it was almost over when an Irish wolfhound that looked like Lon Chaney Jr. in heavy makeup hurled itself onto the hood. Sergeant Alvarez stomped on the gas, and the monster sailed over the windshield and tumbled over the roof. I turned in time to see it get run over by the Humvee behind us.
Damn! Thing wanted to eat us for breakfast, huh?
Alvarez said, wiping sweat off his hedgehog.
You can take that urine sample from my pants now, Professor X.
We glanced at each other for a beat, then exchanged a trickle of nervous laughter.
Now I understand why the politicians are so concerned, I said.
The Marine nodded as he took his .45 out of his holster and put it in the beverage holder.
Typical Washington, right? He said. A problem ain't a problem until it happens in D.C.
Chapter 75. D.C. looked deserted. We passed an army checkpoint on the other side of the Potomac. There were dead dogs scattered pell-mell across the usually pristine National Mall, floating in the reflecting pool. The water was cloudy and dark. I saw that there was a newly erected high electric fence surrounding the White House as we approached it. At each corner of the complex, I noticed four Humvees kitted out with what looked like satellite dishes attached to their roofs.
What are those? I asked. ADS,
Sergeant Alvarez said.
Active denial system. It's a kind of microwave transmitter that heats up your skin. Hurts like a motherfucker. Supposed to be effective for crowd control. Fortunately, it works on man's best frenemy, too.
We got in line behind two other convoys waiting beside the White House complex on East Executive Avenue. Even when it was our turn, we had to wait for 20 minutes while the operation of